Hello. So I'm going to be telling you today about a research program that has now spanned almost a decade, which grew out of a study of systems biology. And I don't want to leave you with the impression that I know anything about biology or that the talk is about biology, although it will have implications. In the end, we've decided that the things we discovered in the systems biology model, a large number of them have to do with fitting models to data. So this is going to be a talk in which I start off talking about models of cell dynamics, and then I tell you something we discovered in these models of cell dynamics that oddly, they have lots of independent parameters that you have to know in order to make predictions, except that it turns out only a few combinations of parameters actually matter for the behavior. And so you can, and so that you can make predictions long before you know all the parameters, oddly. And then we're going to try to explain that, and that's going to move into the realm of differential geometry, which physicists study in order to study general relativity. But the ideas that we need from differential geometry, I think, have an intuitive picture that I can explain, even to the unsophisticated. And then we discover something very odd about the differential geometry that's connected very tightly to this idea of sloppiness. And then towards the end of the talk, I'm going to touch upon two things. One is that all of physics, not just biology and not just other multi-parameter fits to data, but even things like our understanding of critical phenomena and high-energy physics and sound waves, all of these also are sloppy. And finally, that the systematic methods that we use in physics to ignore all of these extra degrees of freedom and that's complicated in the microscale and give simple emergent laws, and I'll explain a little bit about those things, all of those things may be possible to do also in biology. We can take these complicated signal transduction models that I'll start you off with and distill them into simpler models that make sense. Good? That's the plan. Start off, multi-parameter model fit to data. The classic example of fitting models to data is radioactive decay. You take your Geiger counter, and you take a bunch of radioactive things mixed together, and you watch them decay by having less signal with time, and then you want to fit it to the law that you know works for radioactive decay, that if I start with certain amounts of three elements, then the signal will go as e to the minus lifetime of the element times something having to do with the amount of the element. There are six numbers here if I mix three things together, and you can ask, how well does the data tell me these six numbers? And some of you who have sort of been sitting in quantitative situations in the past will look at this and say, this looks like an exponential decay. What do I need three exponentials to fit it? That intuition tells you that it's going to be hard to get these six numbers. And I'm going to tell you it's astoundingly hard, that you would have to have incredibly accurate data in order to actually extract these six numbers from the data. On the other hand, even with a bad theory, I can interpolate between the data points. So this is a range of predictions that I might get for a range of parameters that I might imagine is compatible with my existing data. And no matter what parameters I pick for these six values, as long as they fit the data that I've collected, they would make a pretty good prediction for what happens in between data points. That is to say, only some combination of these parameters actually matter for fitting the data, and the other directions, maybe I don't care whether I have a measurement of them. And finally, there are things that are extrapolations, that if I take my data and I try to extract from measurements less than 6 months and extrapolate over 3 years, I'm going to discover that my prediction is pretty feeble out there. They're extrapolating from noisy data. Taking your theory and extrapolating is going to make poor predictions. Interpolations between data points, you can have reliable predictions. And part of the job of science, or part of the job that we're going to try to focus on today, is to try to figure out what are interpolations and what are extrapolations. What kinds of things can you glean from a model with incomplete information about the individual pieces of the model? Good. Here is the model we started with. I was working with Rick Serione, who's a wonderful cancer biologist, and he was telling us back in the days before systems biology got to be trendy that people, biologists, would spend all their time studying individual proteins and their links to other proteins and never model the whole system. This has become now much more popular with time. And he pointed out this particular system where if I add epidermal growth factor to a given cell type, it would cause cell proliferation, cells would multiply. And if I send another signal into the cell, neuronal growth factor, then the cells differentiated into neurons. Now, those of you who are from physics background, the details here don't matter. Those of you from biology background, this is the last part of the biology you'll probably, never mind. And he drew this little channel, and he said this is why he got into this subject. That he, when he started, there were metabolic networks, but they were far too complicated. He liked these things because they were simpler. And then as he got into it, they got more and more elaborate. And so when you look at this simple picture, he says it's a real puzzle. He couldn't understand how if EGF and NGF trigger their receptors, and their receptors trigger the same set of dominoes, how the answer was different. How come this differentiated and that one proliferated? No, this one proliferated and that one differentiated. And the particular signal is at the end, this stuff goes in the nucleus. ERK goes into the nucleus and causes this change. And in one case, it was known that ERK went up and then down in concentration after about 10 minutes. And in the other case, ERK went up and stayed up. And so the idea was there must be something different about how EGF and NGF started things in order to make this difference. And of course, the problem was that he didn't have the whole network. And in the meantime, by the time I got into the subject, there were all these other loops. So this is the central pathway. And here we have a whole bunch of regulatory stuff. And here we have a whole bunch of regulatory stuff. And the picture is that he gave us is that these things on the side, the left wing, were pushing this down after 10 minutes. So this is an inhibitory side branch. And on the right, we have the right wing here that's stimulating and holding it going. Now, so the picture you're supposed to remember is there's a left wing and there's a right wing, and he thought that both of these were important to make these two different. And there's one other pathway, which is this inhibitory loop up here that will reappear later. And this was the state of the art at the time that we started looking at this some decade ago. So he then said, why don't we model this? And I said, okay, what's the model? And he basically told us enough information that we could write down the model. And you can't read that model, but I'll give you one equation in that model. And here it is. This is a nonlinear differential equation. We're physicists. We can do nonlinear differential equations. You just type in all these equations, and you run it on the computer, and it works fine. And the idea was that we were going to run it on the computer and see if it explained the data. And so the problem was these constants here. He told us all the equations, but he didn't tell us what these constants were. There are 48 of them. And so we asked him, okay, tell us what the constants are. And he said he didn't know what the constants were. And we said, tell us roughly what they were. Well, he could guess within a factor of 1,000. And he said, even if I hired somebody to measure it, they'd only be good to within a factor of 2 to 10, and that I couldn't pay anybody enough to measure them because it was too boring. This was a little bit of a culture clash, you know? The physicists, the quantitative, and the biologists, who cares? But I should warn you, he was right. Knowing the constants will turn out not to be useful. So we'll get back to that, okay? It's amazing, but the fact that biologists have selected their subpopulation, all those people who like to measure constants didn't get tenure. And it's for a good reason, and that's what I'm going to tell you. Okay, so respect your colleagues. If somebody who's famous in their field tells you something you think is just insane, maybe they're right. What we're going to do to begin with is we're not just going to find the best model. So y of theta is going to be our model, and this is going to be our data. And we're going to, theta are our parameters. So you remember there were 48 parameters? I'm going to have 48 numbers I stick into my model, and then I'm going to see how well it fits the data. I'm going to make this thing as small as possible. And that will be this point in the schematic diagram. But of course, my data has error bars. And if I move my data points around by their error bars, I'm going to have some uncertainty in what my parameters are. And so what I'm going to do is I'm not going to just make a prediction with one set of parameters. I'm going to make a prediction with a whole ensemble of parameters. And this is a traditional statistical mechanics thing. This is the sort of thing we do all the time when we study solids and liquids and gases at high temperature. We do these ensembles, and we're really good at that. And we fill up with the Monte Carlo techniques, and we thought we had invented this whole field of doing this for a model. And it turns out that it was invented 10 or 15 years earlier, and it's called stochastic Bayesian analysis. And on the other hand, it was stolen from the physicists back then. And so we're going to populate this thing, and the basic problem is if you have a 48 parameter model, we had this sneaking suspicion that we could predict anything. And then you would make a prediction, and then you would test it, and it would be wrong, and then you would fit that, and you could get that too. And so if we do this ensemble, then anything that fluctuates too much isn't a prediction. It's an extrapolation instead of an interpolation. So we wanted to distinguish those. Now, I'm going to talk about one of the things that's important about this diagram that I'm going to come back to. This is the distinction between bare coordinates. These are the parameters in our problem. These are the rate constants in our reactions or the decay rates of our elements, And then there are the eigenparameters. And the term eigen comes from eigenvalue, which some of you will know from your math courses, and the other, don't worry about it. Basically, there are some directions away from this best fit which have large fluctuations and some which have small fluctuations. And these eigenparameters have to do with the different axes of the ellipsoid around the best fit. So the things that go around in the long axis are sloppy directions, will be sloppy directions, and the things going in the short axis will be stiff directions. So if I move these two parameters in this combination of directions, I rather rapidly get a bad fit. So say this circle is the boundary of bad fits from good fits. If I move in this direction, my badness increases rather slowly, maybe 3 times more slowly. Okay, so we did our ensemble. Do we make predictions? Can we figure out our parameters? 48 parameters in this model. And I was absolutely right that Rick was wrong, that you couldn't possibly pull out the parameters. That here are the fluctuations in the parameters in our model. And the best known parameter, notice this 50, is varying up and down by a factor of 50. A factor of 50. And the worst one is millions. So when Sarrione said, he could figure out his parameters within a factor of 1,000, that's not bad compared to the actual fluctuations. Now, this is not the same as robustness. In biology, there's this prejudice that parameters don't matter. That biology tunes itself so that if some rate constant mutates, it won't kill your organism, and so everything is robust, it can't change. Of course, that doesn't make any sense because you do want mutations to change things so you can evolve and improve. And so there are these papers on this subject, but this is not that situation. It's not that you can change this rate constant by a factor of 50. In fact, each of these constants, if I hold the others fixed and allow only one constant to move up and down, they're fixed within a factor of 2 or so. Okay? And it is not that any one of these parameters is unimportant. It's that combinations of parameters can compensate for one another. So you don't know any of the parameters individually. And the evidence for that, you remember my eigenparameters, the stiff direction, the sloppy directions? If I, instead of measuring the actual bare parameter fluctuations, I measure the eigenparameter fluctuations, then there are a few stiff modes that fluctuate only a few percent. A few combinations of parameters that are tightly constrained. Is it possible we can make predictions even though we know none of the parameters? So Rick Sarrione was right. It's boring knowing the parameters. It doesn't help you to know the parameters. But you can make predictions. So here was the experiment. I'm a theorist. My students are theorists. But this particular student, Kevin Brown, who did all this part of the work, he went into the lab and he did an experiment. So he took this same cycle and he got rid of this guy. He got rid of the left wing. Now, I'm a Democrat, left wing, and he definitively showed that the left wing was unimportant. That is to say, he knocked this out by adding this drug, LY, and he did this Western blot, and the main thing you should glean from the Western blot is never look at the bottom, that's for the referees. And you look at the top and you try to see what the story is. And the story here is that this thing went up and down. You remember up and down. And this thing went up and down, up and down. And this is without ly, and this is with ly. So what does that mean? You remember this left wing was there to suppress things and push them down. And so Rick Serione predicted that when he did this experiment, this one would stay up. And it's clearly not. It's clearly going up and down, and this is the prediction of our model. So our model was right. Rick Serione was wrong. The experiment validated the model. Now, first of all, that's amazing because Rick Serione is never wrong. But secondly, it's amazing not that we got the right answer. That's flipping a coin, right? You'd have to make a lot more predictions to convince a skeptical referee that your model was valid somehow. What was really amazing is we made a prediction at all. You remember that factor of 50 in the best parameter and the factor of million? This is the ensemble of predictions. All those parameter sets gave the same predictions. The few parameter combinations that were tightly constrained, those are the only ones that mattered. And all the rest of them were useless. Okay? Hold that in your head for a moment. We don't know the parameters. They can be all over the place. But we do know that these parameters can't be big and those parameters small at the same time, that there's this direction in parameter space that's tightly constrained. And these few constrained directions in parameter space are telling us what the model will do with a new experiment completely different from the previous ones. So this experiment of knocking out this guy is an interpolation and not an extrapolation. Got it? So here's the picture we draw. So here's a different model, not the systems biology model, but one of these fits to decaying exponentials, like the first slide I showed you. And here we've taken the stiffest direction in this direction, the sloppiest direction in this direction, and you notice that the contours are very closely spaced. That is to say, it costs a lot more to move up and down than it moves side to side. Our parameters in this direction are less well constrained. I've never actually done this before. So I'm going to tell you something. I want you to tell me how many of you noticed it before I said it. I usually say what you haven't noticed is the scales here. That this scale goes to plus or minus 10 to the minus 3, and this one goes to plus or minus 10 to the minus 6. How many of you saw that before I said it? Okay, so I'm lying to you when I say none of you have seen it. This is a bigger audience than usual. So you would have to stretch this a factor of 1,000 in that direction in order to actually see how much thinner this is. A factor of 1,000, well, first of all, it's about a kilometer. I'm in Canada, I'm allowed to talk about kilometers. And also, a factor of 1,000 is about the aspect ratio of a human hair. Okay? Giving you a feeling of how incredibly different the stiff directions are to the sloppy directions. Now, notice the bare parameter axes are rotated. This is saying every single parameter, if I move it, will cross a lot of these lines. All of the parameters are important. Every parameter has a component along the sloppy direction. So the fact that I don't know the parameter combinations along this axis make the error bars in each of the parameters big. So I can make predictions even though I can't know what the parameters are. Cool? So this is at heart what's going on. Now, I haven't explained why it's sloppy. I haven't explained why there's this aspect ratio of 1,000 between the stiffest and sloppiest directions. And I'm going to do that for the rest of the talk, and that will get me into differential geometry and interpolation theory and all kinds of things. Cool? Before I do that, I have to convince you that this is common. First of all, we did systems biology. We took 17 models, actually 16 models, mostly from the SBML database. SBML is Systems Biology Markup Language. This was a long time ago when HTML was really cool and people were trying to mimic it, and SBML was the latest thing. And all of these people had had models, and we took all the models that actually had any data, and then we made up, we wrote a program that would run all these models by automatically loading them, and then we calculated the eigenvalues of the Hessian at the best fit. So you remember the eigendirections I was telling you about on that early slide? The long axis and the small axis. Well, these are proportional to, these tell you information about each of the axes. And this is the model I've been telling you about, the PC12 model, the model of EGF and NGF and all that stuff. And in this column, you can see I've got various parameter combinations. And each parameter combination is roughly 3 times as important as the previous parameter combination. There's one parameter combination that's very tightly constrained, and the next parameter combination is less tightly constrained by a number that's quantified by the number 3. And there are 48 directions in parameter space, and 3 to the 48th is a very big number. And that's what tells you that some of these guys are very, very sloppy compared to others. Now, the factor of 10 to the 6th here corresponds to the factor of 1,000 in the ellipse. So it's really only square root of 3 between them. But many of these models have eigenvalues that continue way down into the floor here. All right? All of these models, every systems biology model we've ever tried, it's not that I selected only the sloppy ones. Every one looks like this. And I'm going to mention in a moment enormous numbers of other models we've looked at. Well, not enormous numbers. Every other model we've looked at also has this sloppy spectrum. So this is our systems biology model I've been telling you about. This is quantum Monte Carlo. These are the most accurate method for evaluating the solutions of quantum mechanics for small molecules. Okay? It's better if you talk to the chemists and they say, if you want to know the energy of benzene, the best way to do it is quantum Monte Carlo. And you take these quantum Monte Carlo wave functions, and there's a variational wave function that you optimize, and then you do the... And the variational wave function that you optimize in the first step of quantum Monte Carlo is already an incredibly accurate wave function. And in terms of its parameters, it's horribly sloppy. This is radioactive decay. This is some of many exponentials. These are things that are not sloppy. I won't go into great detail, but we looked for a long time at various universality classes for random matrix theory, which also have eigenvalues that have the same kind of behavior of plots like this, but they're all clumped very much in a small range of eigenvalues. They don't have this equally spaced and log picture. Okay. I still haven't told you why. I've just given you more of information about what is happening. All of these models not only have some degrees of freedom that are poorly defined, they in fact only have a few combinations of parameters that are well defined and then roughly equally spaced less and less well defined parameters all the way down for many, many decades. It's got to have a reason. So now I'm going to take you into differential geometry. Differential geometry is the study of surfaces stuck in a higher dimensional space. The mathematicians would hate me for saying that. They'd say, oh, we don't need the space at all. We'll just do the surfaces. But I'm gonna think of it as a space. And the space is going to be data space. So here are 3 measurements I make at 3 different times for, say, this fitting exponentials problem. So I have 2 parameters in this problem. I'm going to drop the amplitudes. I'm going to assume that these two are the same prefactor, and all I have are the two decay constants. What is this? This is a two-parameter space of predictions sitting in a three-dimensional space. That's what a surface is. If I assume that my decay naturally, my decay constants have to be bigger than zero, then my entire space of prediction sits on this surface. Okay? And so this is what we call the model manifold. So in our original problem, we have 48 parameters. How big was our data space? We fit all these experimental data points. Turned out we had only 63 data points we were fitting. So we had a 48-parameter model fitting a 63-dimensional space of data. That's a 48-dimensional surface in the 63-dimensional space. The only way that worked, the only way we got predictions out of that, is that most of those 48 parameters were useless. Only four or five combinations actually mattered. And so 63 data points is plenty to specify five numbers. Okay? So here's so we're going to be studying these surfaces. You can see it's a curved surface. That's a nonlinear model. You can see the surface has edges. These edges correspond. So here's the cost contours. You remember the sloppiness. Here's the best fit. Here are these long, narrow canyons. In this case, the long, narrow canyons happen to be horizontal and vertical and happen to be fairly regular. But that's only a two-parameter model. When you get higher dimensions, you get more complicated things. And notice this big plateau. So this is saying if I have two decay constants and both of them are big, then basically my exponential goes kadoom. And then I don't know what to do to improve the fit. I move theta 1 up by 10%. I move theta 2 up by 10%. By the time I hit my first data point, nothing's happening. And these plateaus correspond to the edge of the model manifold. So if I make theta 1 and theta 2 both equal to 0, that's this point. And there's a huge amount of, infinity, that's this point. And there's a huge amount of parameter space out here that all gets stuck to this point. And if I start with bad values of my parameters, my searches get lost. Okay, so the boundaries of the model manifold will be important. This is to say I can take my parameters to their extremes, in here to zero or to infinity, and my predictions stay in a small range. That tells me there's an edge to this surface. So I have a 48-dimensional surface in a 63-dimensional space with edges. And what am I going to learn from that that explains sloppiness? Well, to do this, the one feature I want from differential geometry, the one thing that I am asking you to swallow if you haven't already taken general relativity, is the idea of a geodesic. A geodesic is basically the closest thing you have to a straight line on a curved surface. So the straight lines on the sphere are not the lines of latitude, but they are the lines of longitude. They're the great circles, if you remember great circles. They're the things you get by slicing the globe in half along some axis. The straight lines on the torus look like this. These, if I take two points here and here, the closest thing, the shortest path between those points is a curved line that lies like that. And we have lots of machinery for understanding how to calculate these geodesics in high-dimensional spaces. And if you take that same model manifold I showed you before, and you look at it in geodesic polar coordinates, more or less, it looks like this. This is another parameterization. And the cost on this looks almost like concentric circles, and more generally, almost like concentric spheres. So you remember that long, thin valley, bending and squirming, that makes nonlinear fits challenging. If you could do it in data space, it's just dead easy to find the minimum. You just go straight downhill and you fall into it. And we use that to develop interesting algorithms that I probably won't have time to tell you about. In fact, oh, wait a second. I'm supposed to be able to go to the next. Okay. The model manifold, that thing I was telling you about, and in two dimensions had this funny warped shape, and then I drew it in geodesic coordinates. In general, the sloppiness is translated into this space, and it turns out the model manifold looks like a hyperribbon. How many of you have heard of hyperspheres? Hypercubes. Okay? Hyperribbons. Not a surprise, we made up the term. Okay, but what is a ribbon? It's something that's long and not so wide and very thin, and ours are long and not so wide and thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner 48 times. Okay? And here's an example of measuring those widths. And I'm going to compare these widths so each of the widths in different directions gets smaller and smaller. And here are these eigenvalues, the square roots of the eigenvalues of that sloppiness that I was telling you about. And sure enough, they track one another beautifully. That the sloppiness in the parameters is a reflection of the fact that the space of all possible predictions gets very thin in certain directions. And this is a picture of points peppered along the model manifold after a couple of slices, and you can see it's long, its width is not so big, and then it's very, very thin. And I spent, must have been 3 hours trying to slow that movie down. I never did figure out how to do it. If it wasn't a Macintosh, I could make it slower, but I like Macintoshes. I think I will not spend much time on this one. Why does it have this structure? Okay, so here is the width. This is the long direction, the medium direction, and the thin direction. And roughly speaking, and there are also curvatures there. Let me move to the punchline. Why does it have a hyperribbon structure? I've told you, it's amazing we can make predictions even though we don't know the parameters. Then I explained that by saying it was sloppy. There were some parameter combinations that were stiff and the others not. And then I said the sloppiness came from the fact that some directions of the model behavior had only a small range that they could possibly be. The model just didn't make predictions outside the small range. Now I have to explain that. Why is it a hyperribbon? And that comes from interpolation theory. Interpolation theory is for one-dimensional models, not for PC12 models, but let's do a one-dimensional model. So you have some function like decaying exponentials or something else, and you have data, and then you have a range of possible predictions in between the data compatible with your model. And the whole idea of interpolation is if you have more data points, you get better convergence. You know more about what's going on in between. That makes sense? And then that more information is quantified by a formula. That if your mth derivative is bounded by some value, then your range of possible predictions is bounded by something involving products of differences of time points times that mth derivative over m factorial. And if I had 10 minutes, I could convince all of you of this in terms of just polynomials. And if you look at this, boy, it looks like this is just the range of delta t's. This is each of these, if I call that delta t, and if I use the fact that my power series for my function converges. How many of you remember radius of convergence? This is the ratio test for the radius of convergence. And you just plug it in, you discover that the range of possible predictions is going to go as delta t over the radius of convergence of the theory to the nth power. Okay, so I'm going to get something like a hyperribbon. Why is this the width? Well, if I pick m points, if I pick 1, 2, 3, 4 points, that means I've taken my original model manifold. Each dimension of the model manifold, remember, is the value of a different prediction, of the function at a different time. So if I fix these 4 times, that means I've taken my original model manifold and I've sliced it. I've sliced it along one direction, then I've sliced it along a second direction, a third direction, a fourth direction, corresponding to these times. And then the remaining ranges here are the aspect ratios of that slice. And so it's getting thinner each time I slice it by specifying one data point. The whole range of predictions gets squashed by a factor of delta t over r. That means my width is getting shorter by a factor of delta t over r. If I make delta t over r equal to square root of 3, I've explained sloppiness. All right? Good. We've used sloppiness for a variety of things, and I want to end by telling you 2 of the coolest things that we've stumbled across. The first one is that physics is sloppy. So how do we do physics? This is a subset of physics. Many people do physics without ever doing renormalization group or continuum limits. But a lot of us spend all our time thinking about how to deduce the behavior of an experiment without actually mimicking everything about the experiment. So if I want to discuss sound, I'm speaking, you're hearing, the details of what gas is using doesn't matter very much. If the room was filled with helium, my voice would be a little squeaky, but the sound waves would propagate according to the same laws with only a few constants changed. Those constants are the stiff directions in physics. All the details of the molecular collisions are sloppy in physics. And so if you believe me, you should not believe me until I make that quantified. And so what we've done is we've taken the diffusion equation and analyzed it in a way very similar to the way we analyze the systems biology models, and we get this distribution of eigenvalues. And the eigenvectors associated with these top 2 stiffest eigendirections, the second one is the diffusion constant, and the first one is the overall drift. Good? Over here, I've taken the Ising model, the prototype, critical phenomena, renormalization group, Ken Wilson in the 1970s, and Michael Fisher, and all these fancy people got very famous in Nobel Prizes for figuring out that you could understand why experiments and theory all behave the same way and why magnets and solid-liquid transitions behave the same way by coarse graining. And after you coarse grain the Ising model, you get 2 stiff directions associated with the 2 relevant directions under the renormalization group, the temperature in the field, and then a bunch of smaller eigenvalues. Very cool. In the last 2 minutes, I should tell you what's happened the latest advance that I think is incredibly important and interesting that I was not involved with. This is my student, Mark Tranström, but he's a former student. He's now a postdoc, and he's now a faculty member, and he did this after he left. So this is not my work, but it's amazing. So I've been telling people, they always ask, if the model is sloppy, why don't you just have a smaller model that does the same thing? Why do you need all these 48 parameters? And I would say, on the one hand, I didn't want to just throw away parameters because the experimentalists like them. You know, they want to do experiments to change this parameter. And the second one is that I didn't know how to throw them away because the sloppy directions were these horribly complicated things. So, you know, I'd like to throw away the sloppiest direction. What do I throw away? All these parameters seem to be important. So this is the eigenvector associated with the sloppiest direction. But roughly speaking, all the parameters are important in some combination. And what Mark did was incredibly fun. You remember those geodesics measuring the widths? Well, he noticed that as he went from his initial parameters along one of these geodesics in the sloppy direction, that this complicated eigendirection bent. You remember, the geodesics are as straight a line as you can make in data space as possible, but they bend in parameter space. And it turns out they bend to make the direction that you go off to infinity very simple. And so here were two reaction rates, and if you have two reaction rates both getting into infinity, but one's going forward and the other one's going backward, if they go to infinity in a coordinated way, that just means that this reaction is going to equilibrium. That it gets much faster than everybody else, and so it instantaneously goes to equilibrium, and so you can remove it and make a simpler model. Let me say that again. The boundaries of the model manifold are coarse-grained simpler models. And so he just did this once, and he got a 47-parameter model, and he did it again, got a 46-parameter model. And he started with 48 parameters and 29 ordinary differential equations. You remember the differential equations. You remember the sloppy spectrum. You remember the model. And he did it 36 times, and he got a 12-parameter model that fit the data equally well. Roughly equally well. Almost as well. He stopped at 12 because it stopped being almost equally well. And here, you notice it's not sloppy anymore. It's got a rather tight range. You notice how much simpler the equations are, right? You notice when I draw the schematic, there's the left wing, the right wing, there's no left wing. The right wing has just a bare schematic. The main channel is a bare schematic, and there's one feedback loop. That's all he needed to describe the data. Just remarkable. And his model, his method automatically keeps all the original constants. So this guy, theta 9, which is here, he has a formula for all these constants in terms of the original reaction rates. I think it's amazing. So we may now have a tool for doing for the rest of modeling data what Ken Wilson and Michael Fisher did for critical points and phase transitions and self-organized criticality and things like that, and for which Fourier and Euler did for liquids and heat diffusion in much earlier times. That we can come up with coarse-grained models, or Mark can come up with coarse-grained models that capture the essence of what's going on with a much simpler description, but retaining the power of the original microscopic model. Thank you very much.